Ladies and gentlemen, it is showtime. Please welcome the team of the Fulhamish podcast.
It's the Fulhamish podcast, your independent voice of Fulham FC. My name's Sammy James and welcome to the show today. Brought to you as ever by The Athletic. We're going to be looking back at the international break for some Fulham players and of course previewing Sunday's big game against Everton. Midday kickoff, live on the BBC if you're here in the UK, and maybe a chance for Fulham to get some points on the board before a really, really tough set of fixtures. But of course we know that that game on Sunday is not going to come without its difficulties as well. Firstly, joined by Jack Collins. Hello, Jack.
Hello, listeners. Hello, Sammy. How are we?
Fine, thank you. Have you had a nice international break watching all the football?
Yeah, I love the international break in stark contrast to, you know, pretty much everybody else on earth, I think. I'm a huge proponent of it. I think it's the best type of football and I've loved it. And we're going to talk about some of the things that I've enjoyed most. So that's exciting as well.
And as ever, joined by Peter Rutzler, Fulham's correspondent for The Athletic UK. How you doing, Peter?
I'm good, thanks, Sammy. How are you? I'm complete opposite to Jack. I think the international break is a scourge on all of our lives, so this could be fun.
Great. Well, I will just sit perfectly in the middle and let the debate flow between you all. Well, first of all, let's come on to some Fulham headlines from the international break. And look, there's only one place to start. Probably for us in the UK, it was probably the biggest game of the international break. I imagine Jack will say, speak for yourself. But Scotland versus Serbia, it was a crucial Euro 2020 playoff. And of course, there was vested Fulham interest there. Not only because, of course, I imagine Tom Cairney would have been cheering on all his Scotland teammates as he's so massively invested in the Scotland national setup, but Alexander Mitrovic missed the crucial penalty for Serbia, which ultimately sent Scotland through, and it's their first major national tournament for 22 years. And Peter, from a Fulham perspective, obviously, many of us may have been happy to see Scotland go through, but from a Fulham perspective, it was pretty hard to watch Mitro miss such an important penalty for his country.
It was such a shame it fell to Mitro with the fifth penalty, wasn't it? And I think he got the feeling when it came down to it, the way everyone was slotting their penalties away, that Mitrovic might miss his. And obviously, having missed the one against Sheffield United, and we've talked about his penalty record itself, you know, I've written about it on The Athletic as well. It's not the best. It just kind of set itself up for it. And because it was such an important game, especially for Serbia, who haven't qualified for a European tournament, you know, since their independence, actually. So, you know, it's a massive moment. And I guess from a Fulham perspective, just have to hope that he's able to pick himself up again and get going again.
I guess that's the main thing for Mitro. I mean, I read some articles, Jack, from Serbia that weren't placing a huge amount of blame on Mitrovic, but he wasn't particularly effective in the game either. And maybe first rumblings from Serbia fans that is Mitro the right option up top? He's had such a hard 6 to 9 months. He seems to have to be justifying his place in both sides more than ever.
The one thing about the penalty is it's not actually that bad a penalty. You know, he hits it low, hard. It's a brilliant save, if we're being perfectly honest, from David Marshall. And that probably should be considered. If the keeper makes an unbelievable stop from a penalty, they should be given credit. As much as, you know, you do expect most people to score from 12 yards, that, you know, when you look at it like that, you think, okay, he's hit that low, hard in the corner, and it's a good stop. And that in itself, I suppose, offers some relative comfort. It's not like he's skied it over the bar. It's not like he's, you know, tamely rolled it down the middle. He has forced a very, very good save. It's not going to be much condolence, I imagine, given that his country are now not going to be in the tournament next summer. But, you know, there's something for us in that he has hit that penalty well. And, you know, I think 9 times out of 10 that goes in. So that's something to probably bear in mind a little bit. Yeah, and what you say about justifying his place, I think in some ways he's probably under a little bit less pressure country-wise because of the fact that Luka Jovic has, since his move to Real Madrid about 16 months ago, basically failed to appear, never mind set the world alight. He scored, I think, once in the league in that 16-month period. And in that kind of regard, and given that Mitrovic plays pretty much every week for Fulham, you'd expect that there is going to be elements of, well, you can't really justify selecting someone else ahead of him when he's not playing week in, week out. Yes, it's Real Madrid. Yes, you know, there are other factors to consider, but ultimately he's probably not going to be first choice if he's not playing. That said, he's nabbed three in the international break, and if Madrid can find a way to use him, then you'd imagine that Luka Jovic will be knocking on the door, whether that means that Serbia go two up top, which I actually think might suit Mitrovic quite a lot. It is another question, but I wouldn't be too concerned, you know, especially given what you said about the fact that the Serbian press weren't particularly fussed, I'd say, that it was Mitrovic that made the mistakes. It was the actual game itself where people tended to find fault with the issues.
Yeah, I'll just follow up on that. As Jack was saying, you know, we did a piece on just how it was sort of went down in Serbia, because you do sort of think with it being such a big moment and Serbia not qualifying and everything that comes with it, the pressure of it, you know, you'd think there'd be some kind of backlash. You know, Serbia as Yugoslavia in 98 have their own memories of missed penalties with Predrag Mijatovic missing in the second round against the Netherlands, and that proved so costly. But you know, as Jack was saying, the reaction there is, you know, it's, they're not fussed about Mitrovic. You know, he's actually got a lot of credit in the bank on the international stage. He scored so many goals for them, especially he scored 10 in qualifying. I think he's two off their all-time record goal scorer now. So I think, you know, as Jack was saying, that the focus was definitely on the performance, because they came into that game off the back of a really strong performance against a strong Norway team with loads of good players in it, you know, Haaland and Odegaard and Joshua King, and beat them in extra time, but actually played very well over 120 minutes. So there was more disappointment that they didn't really live up to the expectations. And, you know, Scotland were really impressive in that game. You know, they were on the front foot for most of it. And Serbia didn't show the threats that they do have in their arsenal. And Mitrovic, I wouldn't say he had a bad game, but he wasn't involved as much. You need to get the ball to him. And I think they struggled to do that. And I guess the real question is how he takes it. You know, we see him as a strong character. He always presents himself in that way. And being able to shrug off these kind of difficult things. But this is kind of a big thing to take, you know, there's no getting away from that. So it'll be down to him personally. It'll be down to Scott Parker and the team back at Fulham to try and pick him back up. And I'm sure they will. And it is, he's so important for the club going forward this season as well, as we know, in terms of his goal threat and the options Fulham have. So yeah, it just depends on how he bounces back. But I think on the international stage, you know, obviously there's Jovic coming through, but as Jack said, he hasn't really set the world alight yet. He seems to be in good stead for now.
I mean, there's two players, isn't there, this weekend who with a massive point to prove for Fulham. Mitrovic is hopefully going to try and channel that energy into good ways. And Ademola Lookman, we believe as well, will be trying to make up for what was a massive missed opportunity against West Ham. I mean, I guess, Jack, long term, from a Fulham perspective, Mitro getting a break this summer, considering he didn't have a break last summer, has had this niggling injury, may not be a bad thing. I mean, obviously we don't know if he'll be at Fulham next season, but I guess that maybe is a silver lining from a Fulham perspective, is Mitro having a holiday may not be the end of the world.
Yeah, no, I see. I mean, look, 120 minutes played in that Scotland game, and I was worried, because that's a lot of football, and he's been playing a lot for Fulham. You know, there's a lot of minutes in the tank, but then for him to get an extended rest in the next two games, I think is not the end of the world, like you say, you know, and the fact that, you know, he hasn't had the opportunity to bounce back on the international stage may sit badly with him. You know, I think that there is, you know, a chance that he was the one willing to get back on the line and fight for it and really like show that he can bounce back from this. But equally, if that comes in a Fulham shirt on Saturday, then I don't think, or Sunday, then I don't think any of us are going to be complaining massively. So yeah, I mean, the one other kind of weird narrative here that I don't think you touched on right at the beginning, Sam, was that Tom Kearney is Scottish, right? And the fact is that now Scotland are going to be playing in a tournament next summer. And look, there have been plenty of questions and debates around whether this is something that will happen or will not happen. And ultimately, I think there's more at play here than just form for club. But if you look at it now and you think, okay, the chances of Tom Kearney getting an England call-up are minimal, right? Let's be perfectly honest.
Get an England call-up now? He's played for Scotland.
Not in a competitive game, in friendlies.
Oh, interesting.
He could fully Declan Rice it. But he, you know, much as I disregard that as an idea, and I think it's nonsense, it is a thing that you can change after friendlies. And that was the whole question about the injuries and Scotland saying, oh, is he waiting because Gareth Southgate was making overtures? And look, the bridges may well be burnt. I'm not suggesting that they are suddenly going to reform again. But I think there is questions there that if Tom Kearney goes and shows his worth through an entire Premier League season, that it will be hard for Scotland to leave him out of a squad that is probably lacking a little bit in midfield creativity, right? And the fact that Ryan Gold hasn't been called up for a while, I think it shows you that there is maybe a space here that that can find the would suit someone like Tom Kearney to get into this squad and play. And if he goes to show the form he's been showing for Fulham for the last couple of games and progresses that through a whole season, I think he'll make it very difficult for himself to be ignored if the bridges are still on the table. So there's that element too, which is probably a good thing for us if it is something that might happen.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with Jack. I mean, if that option is still on the table for Tom, you know, he's quite clearly, he's an excellent player and he would clearly be an asset to that Scotland team who, as Jack says, don't really have that creative edge that Kearney brings. He's quite a unique player in that sense. You know, they've got John McGinn driving from midfield and Ryan Christie, who was so good on against Serbia. You know, I think having someone like Kearney in their ranks, it almost wouldn't make sense not to have him. So from a Fulham side, having that option open for Tom would be fantastic for the summer.
One to dig into, Peter, I reckon.
Yep, I'll be on it.
Well, I was going to say, Peter, that your article that you wrote with Ryan Conway, which was kind of a mixture of Scotland and Serbia reaction from that game, and it delved into the Serbia press reaction, is still up on the Athletic UK app. And if you use the web address, theathletic.com/Fulham pod, you can get The Athletic and access to all of Peter's articles and all the other articles on The Athletic. And you can listen to this pod advert-free for just £1 a week, theathletic.com/Fulham pod, if you want to claim that offer. Let's look at someone else who has impressed during their international break is Marek Rodak. Obviously qualified for Euro 2020, sadly, especially for Fulhamish, his very own Lydia Campbell at the expense of Northern Ireland, and then made some great saves as well during their Nations League games. And I'm sure Scott Parker is not going to read too much into how he played during the international break, but good for Marek, I think, is my main overriding feeling, because it's been a tricky couple of months for him, hasn't it?
Absolutely. And also, you know, it's a big one for him because he's not necessarily Slovakia's first choice goalkeeper either, right? You know, obviously Martin Dubravka of Newcastle United is also Slovakian, and he's someone that, you know, has had that number one spot. So for Marek to come in during that injury, step up and make the saves that he did, he was absolutely excellent throughout the international break. But there's a particular save from Lee Griffiths that has drawn the eye, you know, an absolutely unbelievable one-handed stop. And it's one of those things where it's great for him, for his confidence, great for him that he's getting game time, great for us that we have a keeper in form and kind of raring to go and be excellent competition and obviously learn from someone of the experience of Alphonse Areola. So all of these things come to play together, right? And I think as a whole, it just ends up being, you know, good for everybody, this kind of thing. And it gives Scott Parker, I wouldn't say selection dilemmas, because I don't think he's going to drop Areola after the last couple of games where he's been excellent. But it just keeps Marek in mind, I think. And it keeps him, you know, snapping at Areola's heels, which is good competition for everyone. And, you know, I'm mostly just delighted for Slovakia. Those of you that listen to Ranks will know that I've taken on Slovakia as my team for next year's Euros, given the failure of the Republic of Ireland at their hands. And with that in mind, I'm over the moon for Marek, and I'm, you know, excited for the boys come June.
It's that competitive games as well, isn't it? Just making sure he's playing, and having dropped out the team, and then, you know, there's no cup games now until January, having the opportunity to play those matches. You know, maybe this is a point where I'm being quite positive about the international break, Jack. So, you know, fair play for that argument.
Absolutely.
Well, I mean, one interesting one that came from the international break, Peter, and I know you were interested to touch on this, was Stefan Johansson. Now, obviously, we know he's not playing for Fulham at the moment, but he was very much at the centre of this Norway storm, and it's come around because of coronavirus. And that is the crux of this international break. Like, I like international football, I enjoy watching it, and of course the summers are fantastic with it, but like, this international break, considering that Europe is at the height of the second wave of the pandemic, has been pretty bonkers. Yes, I can understand that there were big important qualifiers that needed to be played, but did Nation League dead rubbers between England and Iceland need to be played? And obviously Norway couldn't even field a team at the, during this international break.
Yeah, I'm with you on that, Sammy. I found the international break at this point seems quite crazy. And, you know, it does throw up different situations. You're putting different groups of players together and suddenly you get positive tests and then you're putting other games at risk when they come back to their clubs. And it'll be interesting to see what the fallout is. And that's not even mentioning the injury situation at the moment, because of the way those fixtures have been stacked in every domestic league. And it makes this break seem, you know, from my perspective anyway, I think it was, there are a lot of games that didn't need to be played. That said, I'm a massive fan of the tournaments. We all love the tournaments in the summer, and you've got to try and find that balance. But yeah, the Norway situation was a weird one for Stefan Johansson. Omar Al-Abdullawi received a positive COVID test, and that meant that the Norwegian government intervened and said they couldn't travel to face Romania for their Nations League game, I think. And so, you know, Norway were the only country to do this. The game was forfeited. Johansson, along with Joshua King and Martin Odegaard, released a statement basically saying, you know, we feel we need to be playing this. It's detrimental for the long term, the short term for the country. And it just put Norway in a really, really strange situation where they had to then call up a whole new squad to face Austria for their Nations League game. And they almost won it, actually. denied in the 94th minute. I think that would have actually, you know, I think they would have won the group if they'd held out there. So a really difficult one for Stefan. Obviously, he's not playing. He's not in the Premier League squad, but, you know, he's still training at Fulham. And, you know, it's a difficult situation that, and I guess from his perspective, they'd want to be playing games. If you traveled, you want to play. But then at the same time, as Al-Abdullawi shows, and not the other examples across the Premier League, even Mohamed Salah's picked up a positive COVID test. So test results. So it's really tricky, I think, to have an international break at this point. And finding that balance between tournaments that are necessary and not necessary, you know, I think that could really been looked at. And you're looking at three games in the tight time span. You know, I think it's fortunate, you know, for Alexander Mitrovic, so he only played two and he missed that second one against Hungary from a Fulham perspective. But if you're playing three games in that tight, what, it's about 10 days, isn't it? Then you're traveling back. It's not great. It becomes much more of a challenge. And then it strengthens arguments for five substitutes, which I personally am against a switch during a season. I just don't think that's good for the integrity of a competition. But if you're going to be forcing the players to play this many games, then yeah, maybe you do need to look at that. So yeah, it's a difficult international break, and especially so for Stefan Johansson.
I think there's definitely something to be said here in that, like, even as a gigantic proponent of the international break, I think that there have been too many games, right? There's a difference, I think, between my argument that international breaks are not boring and they're full of really, really intriguing narratives, and this is a dangerous thing to go ahead during a second wave of a global pandemic, right? And getting people to travel across continents and across kind of the world in many cases is potentially a dangerous thing and something that we should have thought about a little bit more. Like, obviously I can appreciate that Nations League games where there's competitive elements actually, you know, for a prize and games that are qualifiers to the European tournaments should probably still be going ahead. The friendlies around them probably less so, right? And that goes for, you know, AFCON qualifiers I have no problem with South American qualifiers, but, you know, you look at the USA playing Wales in Austria and you think, oh, that's a bit weird, right? That even as much as I enjoy the USMNT games, both of them were friendlies, and you do look at those being a bit like, not completely sure that this game really should have been going ahead in current circumstances. So to Peter's argument, I completely agree, right? There are certain things that you look at and think, not sure about that, even if the games I, you know, enjoyed as a whole, you know, holistically, you look at it and think maybe there weren't things that should have potentially happened. And I think the Johansson and the Norwegian situation is probably the best proponent of that actually happening, right?
Jack, just a couple other headlines from the international break from a Fulham perspective. Probably both came out of Africa, really. Frank Anguissa impressed for Cameroon, and Nice Kinskabana with a lovely goal for the Democratic Republic of Congo. Only played 10 minutes, but lovely strike.
Yeah, came off the bench. Got a ball from Gael Kakuta, beat three men and slotted one in from outside the box.
Yes,
an absolutely beautiful strike. You know, beat a few players. It was all very good. I enjoyed myself a lot. And Frank was excellent for Cameroon. They're in this weird situation, Cameroon, where they're hosting the next AFCON, but they still have to go through qualifying, even though it means nothing. So if Cameroon came bottom of their group, it would mean nothing. They'd still qualify because they're the host nation. But because of the number of teams in CAF, they basically put every host through qualification. And if they miss out, then someone else misses out and they just get a space in automatically. But there doesn't appear to be any real danger of that happening because, you know, they're probably going to qualify. So it's a strange kind of element in many ways. You know, they're top of their group with 10 points, 3 wins and draw from 4 games. And there doesn't look like any danger of anyone really catching them. So we're not going to have that issue. But Frank was excellent. Scored in the first game. They won 4-1 against Mozambique. And then, was comfortable in the return fixture. So I think he was a bright spark to come out of the international break. And the other weird one that happened in AFCON that we maybe weren't going to touch on, but I'm going to anyway, is Ola Aina, who played for Nigeria in their second game. So Nigeria played 2 games against Sierra Leone, both of which they would have expected to win, both of which they drew. The first one where Ola didn't feature, they were 4-0 up and drew 4-4.
What?
In one of the most ridiculous collapses I've ever seen. And in the second game, Ola played... and they drew 0-0, which was a bit of a strange one. He played on the left rather than the right, which is where he featured a lot for Nigeria and also for Torino. But then, you know, he kind of doesn't offer that as much going forward. And, you know, Zaida Sanusi, who played there the game before, who's a Porto player, very much got forward and offered quite a lot to the attack in the 4-4, but really struggled defensively. And Ola came in and really shored things up, but they did lack a little bit of that attacking spark. So it's just interesting when he plays on the left, he does lack a bit more, you know, of that kind of thrust that we've seen from him on the right hand side. And yeah, I think, you know, while there's something to be said for that, it was good that he's put in a defensive shift and kept a clean sheet and given, you know, especially given the collapse from 4 days beforehand, you know, gave a good account of himself. So fair play as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, another clean sheet as well, which is so, so important for Fulham at the moment, keeping that defensive solidity. It's nice to see Aina coming in and keeping it solid. And Anthony Robinson as well, getting a clean sheet against Wales. So another couple of clean sheets, one for Rodak. That's bodes very well, I think, going forward. I think with Aina as well, as you were saying, Jack, I think he's, especially for Fulham, he seems to be adapting with every single game we've seen him. You know, he spoke about, you know, adapting to the tempo of the Premier League, and we're definitely seeing that now. I think, especially in his forward play, he's certainly becoming more of a threat from the right hand side. When, you know, we've spoken about who can play in front of him, you know, whether that's Bobby Tuckett-Overeed or Ruben Loftus-Cheek, and having someone who's quite clearly an outlet on that side allows someone like Tuckett-Overeed to drift inside, and he can then offer that creative threat on the overlap and deliveries into the box, which, you know, it's slowly been getting there with week on week. And Kenny Tete can't be too far away now after the international break, which is another bonus of this period. So it's good to see him get another clean sheet. And as I say, it's good to see him progressing with every game he's involved in.
Speaking of clean sheets, Peter, a new addition to Fulham's defence has been Joakim Andersson, and that he's played 2 games for Fulham. He nearly has kept 2 clean sheets. Obviously, we know what happened late on in that West Ham game, but being very impressive during those first couple of appearances for Fulham. And that's, you know, that's hard for a defender to just come into a brand new defence and really boss it and command himself like he has. And really good piece that you put up on The Athletic this morning, kind of a profile really on Joakim Andersson, taking him from his early days at Midtjylland, went to Twente, moved to Sampdoria, moved to Lyon, and then of course to Fulham, and his kind of like trials and tribulations. So I thought it'd be interesting for you to give a small summary of what you found out whilst writing this piece on Andersson. And it all started with a youthful, exuberant experience stealing some Coca-Cola bottles when he was 15. And I loved how you managed to center the entire piece around it.
Yeah, I let it off with the Coca-Cola bottles. It seemed like quite an important moment for him when he was 15 anyway. It seemed to be a story that kept being mentioned when I was asking about Joakim and his backstory. But basically, you can read about it in the piece. I won't give too much away, but basically he stole a load of Coca-Cola bottles when he was at a boarding school at Midtjylland. And he was caught on CCTV, he got punished for it, he got sent home, actually got kicked out of the school for a week. And then basically his dad intervened and just said to him, look, you've got to get your act together here if you want to actually make it. You know, you can you can muck around if you want. You can come back here and, you know, have an average job and do that. But if you want to make it, you can't be doing these sort of things. So it's quite a funny story. It seemed, you know, it's a nice way to lead into it. But yeah, I mean, Anderson's had quite a, you know, circulatory sort of career so far, hasn't he? He's traveled all over Europe. He's not really that well known in Denmark as well, which I found very interesting because he never played for Midtjylland. He was at Copenhagen as well. So he actually grew up about 20 kilometers to the west of the capital, played for a local youth team, was scouted, and then left for Midtjylland, which is actually 300 kilometers away from his home, which is a considerable distance for a young defender, but for a young kid to move out at 15. He then left before making a senior appearance. He went to 20. Midtjylland at this point, they weren't under the auspices of Matthew Benham. Obviously, he's worked wonders at Brentford with their statistical-based approach. So this was before that period. Went to 20, again stepped on. And for similar reasons, you know, Midtjylland had sort of financial issues, which was why the sale was sort of pushed through. And then the same thing happened again in Holland. He actually joined a team with Hakan Ziyech from Chelsea. He's at Chelsea now. Dusan Tadic was there when he arrived.
Yeah.
So some really good players. And then obviously made his name in Italy, actually. One of the former coaches I spoke to, a guy called Ted Van Leeuwen, actually said he sees him as an Italian defender, which was very interesting for someone who, you know, worked with him before he made that switch. He obviously went to Sampdoria and really stepped down. And everyone seemed to speak very warmly of how he got on with Marco Giampaoli at Sampdoria. You know, I think Jack will be able to talk a little bit more about that team. But, you know, they were very impressive defensively. And Anderson himself talks about learning the tactical elements, defensive shadow play, positioning, the gaps between defenders, midfield, the structure of it in a way that he hadn't before. And then, you know, his first season, I think he only made about 7 or 8 appearances. And then it was the second season where he really stepped on and, you know, attracted interest from all over Europe, including Tottenham. Who he met with as well before joining Lyon, which didn't work out so well. They had to change of manager, and coming to Fulham was a way for him to get regular game time and really kick on again. So he's a really interesting player. He's got, you know, he's very driven now. He's really focused. He's all areas of his life now seem to be focused on football, from press to what he eats for breakfast. You know, he has a nutrition coach, but someone who he works with for his food and his fitness. And, you know, he's really sort of stepped on, and now he's arrived at Fulham. You know, he's a multi-million pound defender who, you know, will want to step into what is a competitive Danish team as well.
Yeah, I think that's kind of it. It's, you know, at those years at Sampdoria, you know, I watched him quite a lot, and Giampaolo's formation, the kind of 4-3-1-2, was kind of key to this. And he built up a really impressive defensive partnership with Omar Colley, weirdly, who was linked to Fulham. They were very, very good. And it was one of those sides that really kind of kicked on. Obviously, that was the year that Quagliarella decided he was going to go absolutely ape and you know, take the Italian league by storm at the age of 37 as well. But I think, you know, you looked at those Giampaolo teams and you thought, yeah, this is a team that that's built from a solid foundation, and Anderson was such a huge part of that foundation. And I think what I recall from that year was people trying to sign Anderson and Dennis Pratt, who's now at Leicester, obviously, as like a double deal. I remember it being linked to Arsenal time and time again. And he was the rock. So Colley was part of it. And there was also Lorenzo Tonelli who kind of came in. But it was all based on Anderson being the heartbeat of that defence. And from there was, you know, everything else kicked out. There was, you know, a midfield three in front of him that kind of sort of chopped and changed a little bit. You know, Anderson, Aldero in goal and Quagliarella were the three real, you know, heartbeats of the side. And I think from there we were all expecting, and I remember him going to Lyon and thinking, right, that's a move. That's a really good move for Anderson. And it obviously hasn't worked out as planned. Obviously Lyon are a bit up and down. And I mean, you know, better than most, Peter, from your time in France, how volatile a club that Lyon can be. But, you know, it just, you know, that switch to three at the back didn't suit him at all. And it really did, you know, he really did struggle with that new system. And And the fact that he didn't play very much last year is kind of testament to the fact that he didn't jump in and start into that system. And that's what's always made me think, you know, when we signed all these defenders and there was a lot of people saying, oh, we've got enough to go three at the back when we want to now. But I've seen Joachim Andersen struggle in that system before, and I can't see Scott then deciding not to play to his strengths, because I think ultimately he's probably the best defender we've got. And if you look at that within the kind of greater context, I think it does show that we're going to stick with four at the back. I'm not saying that there won't be elements of a five here and there, and you know, we know exactly what Parker's late game solutions are when we're winning games. But I do think that we will see four more often than not because of the way that Andersen suits it. And yeah, he's a brilliant article beer, and he is a brilliant player on his day. And I remember him being the kind of star of that Sampdoria team, you know, aside from Quagliarello, who was scoring goals for fun. But you're thinking, okay, this is a defender here who has serious pedigree. And when we were linked to him in the summer, I thought, right, yeah, that's a player. And even though we haven't seen his best at Lyon, I think the fact that they've loaned him without an option to buy and without an obligation to buy suggests that they still see a future for him there. And while that's not a good thing for us, I think it does show his pedigree. And ultimately, we're looking at a defender here who very much has the quality. And I expect to see that through the rest of the season.
His time at Lyon was interesting, as you were saying, Jack. I think it seems people were quite open about it. I mean, you know, he made quite a few mistakes in December and January. You can see, you know, that led to goals, and he was sort of in and out of the team. I think Garcia tried to use him in some games, but then he'd fall out of, you know, a favour with Marcelo and Jason Tenaya in front of him. And what was interesting was the tactical element to it. You know, they were saying that he wasn't so used to the one-on-one situations you would often get in Ligue 1 with very quick, very strong and very direct attacking teams. You know, Ligue 1's often derided, but there are a lot of very promising young forward players in that division. And the way that Lyon set up, as you outlined in there, Jack, meant that he was in more situations where he was more exposed, and Lyon liked to play a bit more expansively, and they tried to push on and play near the halfway line. And it was sort of reminiscent of his time in Holland, where, you know, Ted van Loon was saying to me that it's really hard to be a defender in Holland because of how high they play up the field, because of how exposed they are. So you're made to look ridiculous. You know, Holland love their forwards, they love attacking play, but defensively it's never, they don't really enjoy that aspect to it. And it was sort of similar with in France, but just that added element of the one-on-one situations. And I think for Andersen, it was, you know, there was that, and then obviously there was the change in manager, and it just never quite seemed to settle. So for him, it's, you know, now's the opportunity to really push on and get that game time, that regular game time, because he's got one Denmark cap. But as I was saying before, there's some serious competition there. There's Simon Kjær, who's the captain of the national team and plays for AC Milan. There's Andreas Christensen. There's Yannick Vestergaard of Southampton. Mathias Jorgensen as well. So there's some good competition in there if he wants to get his national team place back. So it's a good opportunity for him to really push on now at Fulham. And the big pull, you know, he spoke to Kenny Tetta, which he mentioned himself before. He was really glowing about the tactical side and the training sessions, and he obviously spoke to Scott Parker, who made a big impression too. But it's the way Fulham play and the style of play really does seem to suit him. You know, he's a ball-playing defender. And that was all part of the appeal of coming to Fulham when, you know, there was interest. One of the funny things is Gianpaolo seems to be interested every time he's available. So he wanted him at Milan, he wanted him at Torino. So he's got one fan who will always take
him. I'm not surprised given how good their combination was.
It worked really well. So yeah, it's coming to Fulham is a big step for him, and hopefully he can push on. And we've already seen some promising signs in his first two games.
One thing that I took from the article, Peter, was just about the negotiation of his fee and how A looked like quite a good deal in the end. And as far as your article was concerned, Peter, it looked like Fulham have paid 1 million euros for the loan for the season, and then we pay a further 1 million euros if Fulham stay in the Premier League. But it just gave me a little bit of confidence that obviously Lyon haven't given us the option on this deal, but that maybe a deal, assuming we stayed up, of course, that's going to be key to it, in the future, next summer, if all goes well, may not be impossible, whilst it would probably cost us an awful lot and Lyon would want to recoup the money that they outlaid for him, because it looked like they potentially were interested in selling him permanently this summer, but they couldn't make it happen, so they settled on a loan. It just gave me a bit more confidence than I had before. I was kind of under the impression of, well, we've got him for a season, but we aren't going to keep him next season. But actually, maybe that's not quite as strictly true as I first thought.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's impossible. I think you're right to sort of make that kind of inference. You know, Lyon would have sold him, I think, is my understanding of it, if they had the right fee for what they paid. I don't think that would have been forthcoming this summer. I think that was pretty unrealistic, and they wanted quite a high loan fee, was my understanding, around 5 million euros, which was a lot, and it put off some of Anderson's other suitors. You know, Valencia were very keen as well, Torino, as I mentioned. But Fulham stuck with it. It's why the deal was quite late in the window. You know, it did come down to the last day. He only flew to London on the Monday, on deadline day. So, but Fulham were able to get that down, which was quite impressive, down to just 1 million up front, and then 1 million if they stay up. You know, Lyon post their fees as well once they're done. That's why we know that Kenny Tetta was 3 million euros, absolutely, because they're listed on the stock market in France, so they have to put those numbers out. So yeah, it's a good loan deal for Fulham, and I wouldn't say it's impossible that he signs permanently. Definitely not. Just depends on what the financial outlook is, doesn't it? Depends what division Fulham are in, of course. And but you know, if he has a really strong season with Fulham, you know, if that puts the club in a really good position, if they did want to try and keep him, and especially if they're still in the Premier League too.
Worth adding here that it's an impressive maneuver from Tony Khan, because Aulas is a notoriously difficult negotiator. And, you know, we've seen in times gone by, and, you know, I think the Tanguy and Ndombele deal is perhaps the one that springs to mind straight away, where Tottenham were umming and ahhing, and Daniel Levy, who's, you know, himself is known to be tight with the purse strings, it was a kind of look at, you know, he was going, right, if you want him, this is the price. And every time you come in with a lower bid, we're gonna raise it. So, you know, it's one of those where you look at them and you think, okay, that's it. You know, to negotiate Aulas down from 5 million to 1 million is no small feat. So, you know, credit where credit is due.
Right, we're going to take a bit of a break there, and afterwards we're going to look ahead to Sunday's game against Everton.
This is an advertisement for BetterHelp, a portal for finding online therapy. How's your social battery right now? If you feel a bit drained or lacking enthusiasm to meet all the social commitments in your life, then that can be a totally normal thing, especially with things picking up as we head out of winter. I know that pretty frequently a weekend just doing a few chores and watching the football was about the limit of my energy resources. But therapy can be a place to help you gain the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your batteries. Contrary to popular belief, therapy isn't just for those who have experienced major trauma. The overall goal is to empower you to be the best version of yourself. And if therapy is something you've considered, then why not give BetterHelp a try? BetterHelp is entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. They'll match you with a UK mental health professional with a wide variety of expertise. There's no referral needed, and you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge, giving you complete control over the whole experience. Fulhamish listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/fulhamish. That's betterhelp.com/fulhamish.
Welcome back to the Fulhamish podcast. Sammy James here, and I'm joined by Jack Collins.
Hello, listeners.
And Peter Rutzler.
Hello, hello.
Sunday's game against Everton. Probably the first time a Fulham league game has ever been shown on the BBC, which is obviously good for us in the UK and means that we can all watch the game regardless of what TV package we have or not. It's a midday kickoff against Everton. And Jack, it kicks off a really, really difficult set of games for us. And the fact that we are looking at a series of four games and thinking that Everton is the one that we need to get the points out of just suggests how difficult it is. Leicester away, Man City away, followed by Liverpool coming to Craven Cottage. We've seen this set of fixtures for a while now. We've been talking about it for a while. And this Everton game is the best chance to get something out of it. But they've got Richarlison back, which will of course mean that they are a little bit better stocked than they have been in the past three games since he's been suspended.
Yeah, and you know, James back to full fitness as well, and Luca Dean, who obviously returned for the Man United game but was missing in the games beforehand. This is, you know, a side that looks like they're vaguely back to full fitness. Seamus Coleman might well be out given the Ireland situation with COVID and all of these different bits and bobs. But this is a side that started the season brilliantly, and people were talking about in the highest regard, and then have had themselves a little stumble. Obviously, lost 2-0 to Southampton, then lost 2-1 to Newcastle, then lost 3-1 to Manchester United. So it is, there is precedent for them not being invincible, shall we say here. There's plenty of precedent that they can be beaten, but they will have had this time with Ancelotti, with the break, to recover. And now James played for Colombia. They've had a terrible international window. They lost 3-0 to Ecuador in the latest game, which is, tragic for them. It's the worst start to a qualification campaign for Colombia in years, and James did look a little bit off the boil, so that's something to be rejoicing in, I suppose. And you just gotta hope that we get the bounce from Mitro and coming back and having something to prove, and they don't have a similar thing with James, who will undoubtedly want to put this international window behind him. But they're a really good side. They've bought brilliantly. They have incredible talent and depth in that first team. And whilst the side has obviously come down a peg since James wasn't hitting the heights of those first couple of games, there's no doubt that him, Richarlison and Calvert-Lewin, in the form that he's in, are an exceptionally dangerous front three. There's no doubt that Allen and Decore in the middle, pitched with whoever decides that they're going to play in that kind of other role, whether that be Gylfi Sigurdsson, who really needs to ignite his own season, or Andre Gomes, who's been fantastic that first year he was at Everton, and since the injury has looked a little bit off the pace, but again, is a quality player on his day. And then you look at the back line and you think about Michael Keane and Yerry Mina and Seamus Coleman and the kind of even the backups there, Mason Holgate and Jonjo Kenny, who was obviously on loan at Schalke last year, and Luca Dean. This is a very good side. There's, Pickford, yes, has an error in him. I don't know if he'll play ahead of Robin Olsen, who has had a decent campaign away for Sweden as well. So there's plenty of experience and plenty of talent here. And Fulham are going to have to work very, very hard to beat them. That said, you look at the recent results and you can see that things have not gone their way. And if Fulham can use that to our advantage, then we'll, there is joy to be got here. It's just going to take a very, very impressive Fulham performance to get that joy.
Peter, there's a couple of players with points to prove. Of course, we mentioned that earlier in the podcast. Do you see Scott making any changes to his lineup here? It seems like he's got a fairly settled one. And I guess unless Kenny Tete is suddenly back to full fitness, we won't know that until the press conference, which is probably going to be out by the time this podcast is out. You'd imagine that Scott is going to stick with a fairly similar 11. And if there's a change, it's probably only going to be one.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I think it will depend on what state some of the internationals come back, in what fitness state they come back into the team. There's been some considerable games played, a lot of travelling. It would depend on whether, Scott's been working on something for the last couple of weeks with the players who've stayed behind, whether he wants that balance. So I think, as you say, there's a real consistency now. There's a real stability to the way they play. Like, you can see the way they want to line up. I think there are still some areas that you can definitely see a rotation. We've talked about where Loftus-Cheek fits in. I think with the 2 weeks he's had and working with Scott and working with the team, I think it would be a little bit of a surprise if he's not involved. There's good options in midfield now for rotation, with Harrison Reed available. Mara Lamina should be back to full fitness after his slight issue that took him off against West Brom. So that there are some good options in there that will come back into the frame. Kenny Tetta, hopefully, we'll see on with the press conference. It's on Friday this week, so I think we'll beat it this week, which is good in terms of coming out. So it'll be interesting to see if he's back available. He made such an impression when he played his first few games as well. So, but yeah, coming into a game against Everton that I think, you look at the four games coming up, the four difficult games, this is probably the one that you most fancy for them to take something from if they can. It'll be very, very difficult. They've got players back, Richarlison back, I think, from his suspension as well, which is massive for them. And you really like this Everton team. They've really found some stability and they seem to have clicked. They've finally put all these different pieces that seem to have been just thrown together over the last couple of seasons. They're now sort of, they're almost painting a picture now. You can almost see what they want to be. It's interesting reading some stuff about way Everton have been playing, you know, because of James cutting in on that the Everton right-hand side. It does leave Coleman exposed, and if Coleman's not available, maybe that's an area for Fulham to get at. You know, last couple of games, Fulham have played very well down the left-hand side. It seems to be their sort of main focal point going forward, with Kearney drifting into those areas and Lookman linking really nicely with Anthony Robinson. So maybe that's an area that they can get down the sides of Everton and really cause them problems. But I think, you know, when you look at these four games, and, you know, we've talked about the fixtures repeatedly and how difficult they're going to be, but I think taking no points from the four would be tough. Like that's gonna hurt, and I think that will be then shown in the table. So I think taking something from these four would be brilliant. Taking none won't be great at all. So I think this one's probably the one to look at, and we'll all get a good look at on the BBC as well. So.
And there is a good article on The Athletic that Michael Cox did, alluding to what you said there, Peter. It's about how James Rodriguez's positioning has led to Everton leaking four goals in three games. And it's really, really good read. Again, the code, if you want to subscribe to The Athletic, theathletic.com/Fulham Pod. Right, let's come on to get an opposition view on the Toffees. Dom spoke to Tom Clark from the Toffee Blues to get a lowdown on everything from Goodison Park.
It was kind of momentum at the start, kept us going. I think upgrading the midfield really gave us a boost from having people like Tom Davis and out of form Gylfi Sigurdsson. I'm upgrading that straight away to Alan Abdoulaye Doucouré and James Rodriguez. You're going to get results straight away, and it's going to you're going to see results, and we did at the start of the season. For the first five games or so, we saw a marked improvement, but then after that we just seemed to have completely dipped. It was the first international break, it seemed to dip in, and then we came back, played Liverpool, drew 2-2, and we were lucky to draw that game. It was that late VAR decision against Jordan Henderson, I think it was. And that really shouldn't have happened. We probably should have lost. And then we've lost every game since against Newcastle, Southampton, and then Manchester United as well. So obviously two games we were expecting to win, and then Manchester United game was against an obviously out of form Manchester United, who had a bad result that midweek in Europe. And it was two out of form teams against each other. It's just crazy how we've gone from a really good team at the top of the table to looking like really, really poor. So it's strange, but it's Everton. They get your hopes up and they let you down. We're used to it by now.
So obviously everyone has spoken about James Rodriguez, about, you know, the influence he's brought in. Do you think one of the biggest things he's done is actually not just, you know, bringing his individual quality to the team, but raise everyone else's game?
Yeah, when you bring in a player like that, I suppose everyone else has to respond to that. If he's pulling off these ridiculous things in training and no one else is, it wouldn't be good. And obviously it gives everyone a lift mentally as well, to see people like that around you in the dressing room. It picks them up, and I think that was why we did so well at the start of the season. Just seeing those characters around the dressing room just really gave everyone a boost. A few of the players have said that themselves in interviews. Not that that's worn off, I don't think, but injuries have blighted us in recent weeks. We've had the likes of Seamus Coleman's being out, suspensions as well, to the likes of Luca Dean, Richarlison, which has really blighted us. But yeah, definitely having those characters around the dressing room does give the players a boost, and I hope that lasts longer than 5 weeks.
Are you expecting a reaction to coming out of this international break against a team, against Fulham, obviously a team you'd be looking, you know, with our start to the season, a team you guys were expecting to beat away from home? Obviously, we got that win against West Brom, played fairly well against West Ham, but you guys will definitely be looking to bounce back here, surely.
Yeah, we'll hope to, I'm sure, but the form we're in at the moment, I wouldn't expect it. But obviously, with the international break coming, we could turn that around. And with some players coming back from suspension and coming back from injury as well, Luca Dean will be back. Richarlison, I think, has had three games. He might have one more. But we will have players back who weren't available in the last few games, and that has undoubtedly contributed to our demise in the last few games. So we will have those players back, and we'll hope to be able to bounce back properly. But Fulham in the last few weeks haven't been a pushover, really. Obviously, you got the win against West Brom. Sure, they got a point last week, if it weren't for our old boy Adam Ola Luckman missing that silly penalty. But it's not going to be easy. We can't just come, haven't lost our last three games, come and expect we're Everton, we can steamroll Fulham, because it won't be like that. Obviously, with the players back, we will be expecting a result, but it's not going to be straightforward.
If Fulham were to, you know, get the victory over Everton yourselves this weekend, what would Everton fans start to be thinking about this season? Were they thinking that, you know, the start of the season was just an anomaly, or would I'm not saying Ancelotti's going to be on under pressure, but these players are going to be under pressure to sort of start showing the form they did at the beginning of the season?
Yeah, I think any other manager would be under pressure after a few results in a row. Any manager under pressure after three defeats in a row in football. But when it's Carlo Ancelotti at Everton, he gets privileges because of what he's done in the past, and the fact that he's, as a manager, he's a level above a lot of these players. So the blame gets put on the players rather than the manager. As we've seen, we've made the scapegoat of managers, I think, in recent seasons a little bit, even though they have been poor. But it's really down to the players now. And if we were to lose this one, everyone would be criticising the players, and it would really, really put a down on our season. Because, yeah, as I say, this is the chance we've had, the international break, to recover players, get them back from injury. The likes of Jean-Philippe Aubameyang could even be back towards the end of this month. We've basically never seen. He's played 1.5 games for Everton in 2 years. We're starting to get players back. And if we can keep players fit and not suspended like they've been in recent weeks, we can hopefully return to the form we were in at the start of the season again. But yeah, this is our chance to do it. But if we were to lose this, it would really go downhill, especially with a tough December ahead of us.
Yeah, so it's sort of a similar way that Fulham are looking at this game, is because, you know, we've got a very tough run of fixtures now, playing the likes of yourselves, Leicester, Manchester City, Liverpool. And so Everton at home for us is really one of the games here where we're looking at getting a result, because, you know, it's a home fixture against not a team who last season were in the top six. And for us, this is a game where we could be looking to get a result, especially if we didn't pick up results, for example, at home to Crystal Palace and away to West Ham. This is a game where we're looking at saying, well, if we are going to stay up this season, this is the kind of games where we need to, you know, get a win or get a point to sort of to get something on the board, really. You're looking at Fulham's team. What areas of it sort of concern you the most?
The problems were quite public. The owner was saying he couldn't bring in a centre-back for a while. He was able to bring, I think he publicly said it was what, his fourth, fifth choice centre back that he brought in the end, which is it's quite defensive on the players he did bring in the end. But I think that team's starting to play together better, it's not a weak team. I do think there are a few Championship players in there. That's the unfortunate thing. I think last time Fulham came to the Premier League, they did splash the cash. They brought in the likes of Shearer, Seri, Babel. And now they've come this time and gone for a slightly more conservative approach in the way that let's keep the team together. And it's bringing a few additions to try and up the quality, but not disturb it too much. And I do think there are areas of the side that we can exploit, and hopefully that will be up front with Dominic Calvert-Lewin threatening the defence if we can. But obviously our defence is quite suspect ourselves, and I can certainly see Adam Olatunji getting a goal. And you've obviously got other players in strong positions as well. We know the quality of Anthony Robinson at left back as well, and I do think you've got some quality players in there, even coming off the bench, the likes of Ruben Loftus-Cheek in there as well. So there are areas we will be looking to exploit, notably the defence. But there are areas of strength in there as well.
Do you think the likes of Anthony Robinson and Adam Lookman are going to kind of want to prove a point this weekend?
Yeah, especially Lookman. I think Robinson has a lot of respect for Everton, I still think. But at the same time, he obviously will want to prove a point because he didn't get his chance at the club. I think he should, personally, he should have done, he should have stayed. But he never, we sold him to Wigan in the end, and then you guys have picked him up. But he'll be looking to prove a point. But mostly Adam Olatunji, I think, because that didn't end on the best terms. He went out on loan to Leipzig when Ralf Rangnick was the manager. And he really enjoyed that. He got a good few chances. And then Rangnick moved position. I think he was promoted to head of sport at Red Bull operations. And then it was a different manager when Lookman returned. He didn't get the chances he needed. And it kind of all went wrong for him. And I think he's had a point to prove ever since. So this game, especially coming back to Everton, where he really wasn't happy with his playing time, is definitely, it will be a point to prove for Lookman especially, but obviously Robinson a little bit as well.
Yeah, and if we're looking obviously at our front line, you say your defensive problems. Do you think it's something that Fulham should be looking to exploit with the likes of Alexander Mitrovic up top?
Definitely, Mitrovic is always a handful for any defender, and especially when we've not got our first choice potentially available. I think Holgate's coming back. He looked a bit rusty last week, and Michael Keane made a couple of mistakes as well. Both centre backs made mistakes against Manchester United, and you can't really make many mistakes with a striker like Mitrovic, who's going to stretch it and he's going to be physical and be demanding of you. And I don't think our centre-backs are in the best form, judging by the last game. Hopefully they can return to some form after the international break, but yeah, they will have a handful with Mitrovic, and whether they can actually respond to that, I'm not sure. I'm not sure, to be honest. I do think it will be Mason Holgate and Michael Keane starting, but Mitrovic can get the better of either of them on his day.
Yeah, I think a battle in the game I'm sort of looking forward to is that everyone will be speaking about Calvert-Lewin, Mitrovic, Lookman, you know, the attacking. But I think the midfield battle could be quite an interesting one, because obviously you'd like to have Decore, Alan, and obviously James Rodriguez in there. And then we've got, you know, Anguissa, who's a powerhouse through the middle. I think it's a weird stat that he's got one of the most dribbles for a centre midfield in the league, just because he's driving through. And then whether we play Harrison Reed or Lamina with Kearney further forward, I think that's actually going to be a very interesting battle, because Both teams, I'm not saying they want to dominate enough 70% possession like Manchester City do, but they're both teams who like to have the ball, play it through the midfield and sort of attack. So I think it'll be quite interesting to see, you know, how, you know, Alan and Decore, like, and your central midfielders deal with Tom Kearney, who's been a lot better in the Premier League this season than he was last season. And he's another player with, you know, a light Lookman, who's got a point to prove here, really, that, you know, he wants to prove that he is a Premier League footballer. And so I think that'll be very interesting to see. We haven't spoke too much about, obviously, the midfield behind your attacking line. How have you been impressed with him so far this season?
Yeah, obviously that was what the instant upgrade I was talking about earlier in terms of bringing in Alain Decore, James, in place of players like Tom Davis and Sigurdsson. Sigurdsson's obviously playing a role this season, but the upgrade in midfield has been the most notable thing about the 17 team, certainly in the start of the season. Alan suffered an injury. He was called up to the Brazil squad last week in place of the injured Fabinho, and he did suffer an injury, meaning he'll be out of the, I think they've got a midweek game, I think tonight possibly, or last night, and he was ruled out of that game. So whether he'll be fit for Fulham, I'm not quite sure, and that would be a big miss, because he pretty much protects the back four. He gets on the ball and dictates the play as well. He's a really, really good quality player, and he would be a big miss, because recent weeks we've seen the likes of Andre Gomes and Gylfi Sigurdsson playing together, who are just too slow, and you'll have people like Anguissa just driving through them easily. So if Alan's fit, I do think that's a big thing for Fulham to take advantage of if he's unfit. But if he is there, not sure whether he's fully fit at the same time. So that's something to potentially look to take advantage of for Fulham.
So if we're looking at the team that Fulham could face on Sunday, what sort of team are you expecting Ancelotti to field? Like, what sort of starting lineup are you expecting to see?
It'll be Pickford in goal. And then along the back, I'd say Holgate and Keane centre-backs. Luca Dean will likely come back in at left-back with hopefully Seamus Coleman at right-back. Now he's back fit again. I'm not too sure about Alan, but Ancelotti doesn't seem to have much problems with playing players who aren't fully fit. I only think it's a slight problem. So I do think he'll start alongside Decore. And I'm not really sure about Andre Gomes, because he has been out of form. He was taken out of the team for a game. So maybe I think he'll be brought back in this game to try and get his form back together again. And then looking at the front three, it'll be obviously Dominic Calvert-Lewin. James Rodriguez, if he's back fit, I think he's been playing with Colombia this week, so he should be okay. And then out wide, Richarlison is back from suspension. He's had three games, so he should be back in for this one. So I'd expect Richarlison to come back into the team and start on that left-hand side, which will give us a massive upgrade. So pretty much back to full strength for Everton, hopefully, fingers crossed.
Yeah, I think it'll be a very, very interesting game between both sides. Obviously, you guys need to be bounced back on a poor run of form. We'll be looking to get straight back from our loss to West Ham. And I said in our run of form, this is probably the easier game. And we'll be looking to get, yes, it's going to be interesting, because both teams are going to be definitely looking to get 3 points, especially with you guys. We both got tough runs of form, kind of like you guys are in bad form. We had that devastating loss at West Ham in the last minute and missed that penalty. But if you're going to put a score prediction on the game, Tom, what are you going to go with?
I do think there will be goals, because obviously we're quite vulnerable at the back. If I were to guess, I'd go with a 2-1 win for Everton. That's a hopeful one, but yeah, that's my prediction.
Welcome back to the Fulhamish podcast, and thank you very much to Don Betts and Tom Clark from the Toffee Blues there, giving us a lowdown from Goodison Park ahead of Sunday's game, which, as I mentioned, is live on the Beeb, 12 o'clock on Sunday. Well, last thing that remains for me to say is thank you, boys, for being on the pod today. Some great insight into the international break, a little bit of a fiery debate over its necessity, and of course, great to get that lowdown on Joachim Andersen. So, Jack, thank you very much.
Thank you, Sammy.
And Peter, thank you very much.
Thank you too. I mean, it wasn't too fiery, was it? I think we sort of found some common ground in the end.
I think so. It's been a debate that's kind of been going on in the underworld of Twitter, I think, for the last couple of weeks. And I'm a little bit fed up with the back teeth of just the debate. It'd be nice to get some club football back in our life, even if these next four games are monumentally tough for Fulham to get anything from them. But we'll keep our fingers crossed, and hopefully the boys can deliver a surprise point or three on Sunday. That would be absolutely delicious. So thank you very much for listening. I'll be back hosting the Sunday podcast, looking back at that Everton game. But until then, have a great weekend. Come on, you Whites.
You Whites.